Welcome to Inside Analog Photography Radio Program. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is all about traditional process photography. We talk about instant photography. We talk about black and white. We talk about color film. We talk about dry plate, wet plate, you name it, alternate printing processes, everything going on in analog photography. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is brought to you by Fujifilm over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. They have beautiful C41 color neg, black and white, color chrome, and of course, instant. Instant film rocks. These guys have so much great things going on right now with instant film. Of course, they have the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4 by 5. Color, black and white, high speed black and white. But you know what's even cooler? They have the Instax cameras and film. The Instax Wide is in the country, available everywhere. And of course, right now, brand new, the Instax Mini is now in the U.S. They have cameras. They have film. This Instax Mini is 2.5 by 3.5. It's the size of a business card. This is really fun stuff. You got to check it out. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your film to get developed, proofs, you name it. They got a great workflow going. www.richardphotolab.com, DR5. For the most unbelievable proprietary process to turn your black and white film into positives, into chrome. You won't believe until you get your film back as a piece of chrome will blow your mind. The dynamic range, the latitude, it's just unbelievable stuff. Definitely check it out, www.dr5.com. Iger Studios, Lenny Iger, the place to have high-resolution scans done. You know, a lot of people now are shooting analog. They're using a high-resolution scan. They're making digital negatives on an inkjet, or maybe they're going straight to an inkjet output. But they're making digital negatives and they're printing contact prints. They're doing all the stuff you need to get a high resolution scan. They're using an Aztec Premier, 8,000 PPI, adjustable aperture. They can give you scans that are basically grain free. They can adjust it for every kind of film out there. This is crazy stuff going on with Lenny Iger and the guys at Iger Studios. Check them out, igerstudios.com. And of course, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. The camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder. Our media partners, www.apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group, the place on the web for all things analog process. This is a great place to learn, to share information, to get tips and tricks, the community for analog photography, www.apug.org, and of course, our photographic philanthropy partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, www.geh.org, the place to go to find out about the history of traditional analog photography. These people are keeping this alive. They have over 7,000 cameras in the museum of everything that's ever been made, including the Hasselblads that were shot on the moon. You name it. They have the collection. This is a great way to help support. You can be a member of George Eastman House organization. They have a lot of great things going on, but this is something you can do to help give back to photography, to help keep traditional analog photography alive for generations to come. Definitely check them out, www.geh.org. This week on Inside Analog Photography, we're going to have with us Stephen Schaub. Stephen is the leader of the Fidgetal Revolution, and we're going to be doing a report about Photo Plus Expo 2009, just concluded in New York City at the Jacob J. Javits Convention Center. We're going to be talking with Stephen today about his thoughts about the state of the industry of analog photography, what he saw at Photo Plus Expo, and what he didn't see. Stephen, how you doing today, buddy?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us again here on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you back on the program and just talk about things here in the analog space. You just attended the annual Eastern Photographic Convention and Trade Show Photo Plus over there at the Javits Center in fabulous New York City. And that's what I wanted to chat about that today and some of the other things that you have going on that I think is very cool that we'll get into. But tell me your thoughts on Photo Plus. You've been going to the show now for almost, well, 15 years plus.
Yep. It was the smallest show I've ever seen in the last 15 years. There was also sort of, sort of a lack of excitement at the show that you'd seen sort of in previous years, mainly when the show was back, being predominantly analog and through the transitions and all the different rollouts. There really wasn't that much. There were a few things, but there really wasn't that much at the show that was exciting. A lot of the big dealers and the big vendors weren't there. And as a result, it was definitely, as I said, sort of a somber show, I guess is sort of the best way to describe it.
So let's talk about this. So as a digital photographer, I'm sure there was ample goods to be seen.
Yep.
Of course, we have the introduction of the new Canon camera, the new Nikon. So I'm sure that was the big buzz at the show. let's go find a camera that I'll shoot video to, and maybe it'll make us a latte when we're done.
Exactly. I think Canon had their thing. Nikon had their thing. Some people were over at the Olympus looking at their new fourth thirds offering. Leica, of course, had the F2, which now, of course, is delayed, and we'll have to see when that actually really comes out. The M9, people were fondling the M9, and their new X1, I think it is. But for the most part, a lot of them had been announced enough in advance that they were the interest, but it wasn't like previous shows where there was just a big bang. Those were sort of very spread out on the show floor, and there were some big companies that were missing from the show, I think is what caused this sort of energy drain at the show. The Fuji wasn't there, the Mac Group wasn't there, Hasselblad wasn't on the floor, Panasonic wasn't there. I'd actually wanted to go see the new GF1, and they weren't on the floor. That definitely made the show limiting. And from an analog standpoint, I mean, Kodak, as far as I could tell, was the one company doing a lot of stuff with analog on the floor. Everybody else seemed to be absent.
Right, because we had, of course, no Fuji at all, so right. There was no analog presence there. Anything with Ilford or nothing?
Not really. I mean, they were there. They had some of their products, but it wasn't a huge presence the way it had been years past. To be honest, one of the largest presences of analog at the show was Lomo. I mean, they had their booth, and they had their plastic cameras and all of that. And that was a decent presence at the show, and a lot of people were looking at Hogas and Dianas and stuff like that. And then Kodak had their booth where they were giving out free film, which is something I guess they've been doing for quite some years here, that they give two free rolls of film. And what was interesting is that the line at the Kodak booth must have been 50 or 60 people deep, nonstop, all day. I never once saw a break in that line. Now, granted, people will get in the line for anything that's free, but it was amazing the amount of people who were interested in getting two free rolls of film. I actually asked Kodak how many rolls they had given out at previous shows, and they thought they would equal the same at this show. And at the last photo show, they had given out 7,000 free rolls of film. So, I mean, that's a lot of film.
Now, honestly, do you think the people that were standing in the line for this film actually truly had an interest in analog photography and wanted to take pictures with it? Or if it's something that they wanted to hork up on eBay?
And that is a good question, because people, just anything's free, they'll stand in line to get. I think that the vast majority of the people seemed genuinely interested in getting the free film and wanted to seem to use the film. And I did actually approach some of the people in the line, and I know Kodak was approaching some of the people in the line and asking them what they were going to do with the film, what cameras they were going to use with it. So there definitely seemed to be a good interest, and of course that made me happy that there were people out there who really wanted film. That was, I guess, sort of me from an analog standpoint, sort of the shining moment of the show, was that there at least seemed to be a good interest. And there wasn't a whole lot of analog on the floor. I mean, it was really Kodak, Ilford had a small presence, and Lomo had a presence. And that was really the big ones on the show floor.
Well, I mean, no view camera stuff. There was no one there with field cameras. I mean, there was nothing. That was it.
Yeah, not the way there used to be. I mean, Snyder had their booth set up with their B&W stuff. But it wasn't like previous years where you would have found a lot more of that stuff. And I think because of the recession, I think you could see the effect the recession's had on the photo industry at the show. I mean, it was just so thick in the air. And you could tell that the people who were at the show, I mean, they were working it for everything they could because of the cost of going to the show was so tremendous. But as I said, there really wasn't that much that was just, to me, truly exciting. There were a few things, though. I mean, Canson had a new paper that they released, the Bereitta Photographique. And I tested it and written an article on Fijital before I went to the show. And it was really, really, really well received. Hahnemühle was there and showing off the Monet canvas and stuff like that. But there wasn't, as I said, sort of the big rollout all around. She said Nikon had their new stuff, Canon had their new stuff. But it was definitely thin, which in some ways I guess is good. In some ways I guess maybe this is the breather that the photo industry has needed to take for a long time now, considering the rapid pace that stuff has been coming out at previous shows.
Right. It seemed that the whole buzz of the show is just melancholy.
A year ago, when the whole recession sort of hit, I wrote an article on Fijital Revolution talking about how I sort of saw the recession playing out. I said, I think you're going to see a lot of consolidation. And I said, I think you're going to see a lot of these digital companies going to fare worse in this recession than the analog companies will. Primarily because the analog companies have got sort of an established product. They, for the most part, own the facilities that are making the products and don't need the sort of fast turnaround that a lot of the digital camera companies and software companies need. Right, their pace is every 6 to 9 months. And I think you could see that at the show, that a lot of the high-end digital camera companies and software companies, Adobe wasn't there. You could see that that's really hit them hard. In a way that I don't think the analog side quite got hit by, but it's not like there's anybody selling darkroom sinks. Those days are definitely gone.
Yeah, that's too bad. And of course, there's a few guys in town left selling stuff, but even the areas over at B&H, their analog section is to nil. I mean, it's too bad that you can't go to a place and really absorb analog resources. There's no trade show for film photographers.
I agree. And the thing that concerns me a lot, too, is that, as you said, there's no trade show for film photographers. There's also a lot of interest, I think, still in film, but a lot of that information is being lost. And at the previous shows, in previous years, I mean, you could get around and you could get a lot of information about analog materials, different film cameras and different ways of working and different developers and processing. None of that was at the show. If you went to the show looking for that, you weren't going to find it. It was nowhere to be seen. And I remember when it made the flip, it was probably about 8 years or so ago at this point, where at 1 year's photo show, Durst had enlargers out and you had Jobo on the floor and you had all these different companies. And then it seemed like within a year or so, there was the one lone guy selling darkroom sink thermometers. It literally flipped that fast. And I think, though, now what you're seeing is because of the economy, you could really see the digital people taking just a massive hit.
What do you see moving forward with what you've been doing personally, people that you talk to, clients that are coming to you that are still shooting film, and a lot of them are?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What do you see with the whole organization of Photo Plus and trade shows and this stuff for film? I guess if someone stepped up and did a conference and a trade show on analog, it would be different. But it just seems to me that was it even worthwhile for you to even leave your back door to go to New York?
That's always a question because it's expensive to go to these shows. It takes a lot of time and it's time that I'm not in my studio doing my day job. I don't know what the future of these shows are. I mean, they're so expensive for a vendor to come in. And it's also expensive for the average person to go in. I mean, I live in Vermont, so it's a 4.5-5 hour trek down. And it's expensive to stay in the city and have the meals. And it's kind of like what's going on with the whole actual printed magazines. There's not a lot of them producing really good content much anymore. So many of them have sort of gone to the wayside. But I think these photo shows at a certain point, I mean, I like to go and see the new product, but I can walk into B&H and do that for free. Paying $25 or $35 or $45, whatever they were charging at the door to get in, at this point, I think they should be letting people in because they need to be drawing that sort of crowd in. Now, granted, you could always do early registration and stuff like that and get free tickets, but I've always had sort of a mixed feeling about photo shows. One thing that always cracks me up is sort of my little personal joke when I walk around on the photo floors are the people walking around carrying every piece of camera equipment they own. Have you ever seen that? You see guys are walking around, they're carrying like 60-pound backpack with three lenses, they got two lenses around their neck, and I'm like, what the hell are you going to photograph at the photo show that you need a 600 2.8 lens? There are so many photographers who do that, and I think they kind of feel like if you're going to go to a photo show, you have to bring your camera. I can honestly say I brought my little pinhole camera, but that was just more to show. I didn't bring anything to really take photographs with, and I never have. Every photo show I've ever gone to, I said, why do I want to bring my stuff to the show? If I want to try a new Leica lens, Leica will have camera bodies there that I can stick that lens on. Nikon had more of the B3Ss or whatever the new camera is on the floor. You didn't need to have your own. Matter of fact, somebody asked me who was going to meet me at the show. They said, should I bring my camera gear to the show? And I said, do you really want to lug around 30 pounds worth of gear all day long at the Javits Center? Why? That just doesn't make any sense.
Well, no, I mean, here's the deal. If you're in New York City, you should probably carry a camera. Okay, so sure. To have a Leica or one camera over your shoulder because you're a photographer and you take pictures?
Not a big deal.
Okay, right. But to take a backpack full of gear?
Yeah, and it's funny too because I'm like, okay, if you're going to bring a camera to a photo show, do you really need a 300 or 400 millimeter zoom lens? I mean, I could see maybe a 50 or a 20, but it is just kind of weird. It's sort of something that I've always noticed at every photo show, no matter which one I go to. I agree, carrying your sort of everyday camera, especially if you're a street shooter or something like that, that's fine. But guys walking around with their backpacks filled, that's just weird. And that's always been something that struck me about these shows. But yeah, so the show just sort of, in general terms, I said, it was sort of somber. I mean, the people were doing their best to sort of pump it up, and there were some good speakers. And that's one of the other things that drives me crazy, though. If I'm walking around with some people who I met in the city, and they're sitting down listening to these speakers, and I understand that the companies who are putting on the booth, the speakers there to help present their product. And the speakers are showing their works in most cases and talking about how they do stuff. But boy, I'll tell you, they've got to stop the constant plugging of the gear during the talk. There was this one woman, I don't want to say which booth she was at, but I mean, every other word out of her mouth was how this camera basically did her laundry, gave her a back rub.
Canon or Nikon?
It was Nikon, but that was true though with all of these companies. I have to, full disclosure, I have to say that I've been in situations like that before too, where you're drawn to these shows and the people are there and they're hoping that you'll talk about their products. But it seemed to be over the top to me at this show. And I think it was because everybody was nervous about getting their full value back out of the show, all the vendors.
It just shows me they're desperate.
Oh, yeah. And it came across that way. It was like the sales pitch was so thick that, to me, it sort of really turned me off. I couldn't sit there and listen to it, but I felt like I had to pull out a weed whacker to sort through the sales pitch that was being beat over my head to actually hear the real content.
Well, it's the truth. And at least Kodak had some tack and they had some film there. And if you wanted to try some emulsion, that was great. If Fuji would have been there, I'm sure they would have been glad to give you what you need to play with.
I'm sure.
But they're not sitting out there with a Barker from Atlantic City with a microphone on their head screaming at people.
Right.
Come get your Ginsu Digital.
And I felt bad for the photographers because some of them were showing some very good work. And it would have been interesting to hear them talk about their work. And I think it would have been more effective in a sales standpoint if they just said, I use this gear because I love it and because it lets me do my work. Now let me talk to you about the work. I think that would have been a better sales point than having to go through the entire speech, just constantly referencing the camera or the lens or whatever they were doing. It just was overplayed, and more so than I've ever seen in any previous year.
I wonder if that was inflicted by the manufacturer saying every sixth word better be Canon, Nikon, Pentax, Olympus, or Leica, or was it just photographers that were freaked out that they had to give it out for the man because the man sent them to New York City for free?
It probably was a little bit of both, but I think the most part, my suspicion is that it's the manufacturer. Basically, I mean, all you have to do is look at the reports of what the financials are of these companies coming in right now. And they all knew what those reports were before the photo show.
Well, sure. Well, I mean, look at the report from Canon. I mean, basically, point-and-shoot sales were down like 9%, 10%. And the only thing that the guys in Japan said during their earnings call was that basically some of the inkjet things and the 5D Mark II was basically, I mean, the only thing up. Office copiers were down, cameras were down, lens sales were down, point and shoots were in the can.
Yep.
I mean, how many billions of point and shoots can you sell every quarter until you start hitting a saturation point? The sponge is only going to hold so much water.
Well, and that's sort of the whole thing. What's a sustainable future for photography? And that's where at least the previous business model that photography was built on, the analog model, worked. And we know it worked because the industry survived for a real long time. And it survived through good times, and it survived through bad times. The problem with this digital model is that it's like something that has an insatiable appetite that can never, ever, ever, ever be quenched. And what they do is they just continually roll out product after product after product. In most cases, they're just micro upgrades compared to what the previous product was. And in order to get you buy it, they just stop writing software or codes that allow your old product to work with the new software that's coming out by Adobe and the other companies. So you're always having to, one degree or another, be upgrading your equipment or software. And I think we have reached that saturation point. I think we've reached that point where photographers are saying, my upgrade used to be a new $5 roll of a new film that came out by Fuji, Kodak, or Ilford. Whereas now my upgrade is this multi-$1,000 camera. And it just doesn't make sense. It's not sustainable.
No, I don't think it's sustainable. And I think that people are actually starting to figure out that I can go buy a Mamiya C220 with a beautiful piece of glass that's basically brand new for a couple hundred dollars on eBay and shoot stunning photography. And guess what? I can keep that camera till I'm dead and it will shoot stunning photography.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the Digital Revolution Manifesto, when we wrote the book, one of the analogies that we used, I have an old Leica M3 double stroke.
Right.
A distant relative who passed away and left it to me. And I can still go out, put a roll of film in that camera, and it works today. Leica just introduced the M9. Do you think that camera is going to actually be able to interface with any software in 10 years, 20 years? Probably not.
I don't see
how. And that's the part that scares me. Right. You can go out right now and buy a Mamiya C330. You can buy yourself a great Blod and have amazing technology, beautiful scans from this material. I think a lot of people are doing that. There was a lot of interest in that. And I've been hearing about it from people who are reading at my websites wanting to do that. The comment that a lot of people make to me is that I'm basically broke and I'm giving up on digital because they can't afford it. They can't afford the constant pace of upgrades. And it's also not easier in terms of the learning curve, in terms of having to maintain stuff. And don't get me wrong, I love digital for an awful lot of things. I do it every single day. But I think that there needs to be a better balance. And I think this recession, and from what I saw at the show, I think the industry hopefully is going to find its balance over the course of maybe the next year or two. Because at the show, it was definitely sort of on wobbly feet.
No, and I mean, so here's another thing. Let's get on another rant here that I can shoot film, but I want to do my own prints and I want to put online portfolios. And at some point, you got to scan your stuff. So either A, you can pay your lab to do it. And there's a lot of labs that are using Noritsu and Fuji SP roll film scanners, and they make some beautiful stuff. And you can get a great looking 8x10 or maybe even 11x14 from a high res Noritsu, okay? The blacks are terrible, but nevertheless, right. Fuji does a lot better with the black stuff. But either way, let's talk about the state of photo scanners. I mean, you're at the show, you're looking at the new stuff. A, Hasselblad wasn't there, so you can't look at no Imicons, and they cost 20 grand anyway.
Right.
You can buy one on eBay used for a few grand, an old one, and maybe you can get a SCSI to Firewire adapter and rig it somehow, and it'll work, and it'll probably be pretty good. So basically, you have Epson. Epson's making some beautiful flatbed stuff, and their V750M rocks with a wet mount, and it's a very cool scanner, and you can do, I think, really good work with that. But let's say you want a dedicated film scanner like a Nikon.
Right.
Can you buy them anymore? Did Nikon have any at their booth? What did they tell you about their film scanning deal?
Well, it was really interesting. Before I went to the show, I made this list of who I wanted to go to and ask very direct questions. And one of the direct questions that I put to was to Nikon, saying, what's going on with your scanners? Because they've already said that they're not going to upgrade the software to Snow Leopard for Macs. So if they're not going to upgrade the software, what does that mean? I'm like, okay, wait a minute. You're not going to upgrade the software to support the new Mac. I asked the very direct questions. They put me in front of this PR guy who's there. And I asked him, I said, is Nikon going to continue to make film scanners? And he didn't answer the question. It was like he was reading off a card. It was Nikon supports and values professional working photographers. And Nikon at this point cannot comment. And I looked at him and I said, stop, just stop. Are you going to continue to make scanners or aren't you? And this is the classic mistake that these digital companies have made time and time and time again. If there's a problem with your paper or your product, don't hide it. Come out and say what it is. Hahnemühle made that mistake recently on their photoreg Beretta. There were the black specs. Everybody knew about it. I called up Hahnemühle and I said, what gives? And they came out and told me, and they gave me the batch numbers that were bad. So I posted them on Digital Revolution. I don't think they liked that, but I posted the batch numbers of all the paper that they knew was bad. Yet they didn't recall it. They weren't giving people their money back, but this was the bad numbers. At least the information could be out there. Nikon's making the mistake that they're not coming out and telling people, at least with a reasonable amount of time, what their sort of business intentions are. And as a result, they're really stirring a whole bunch of sort of bad feelings with working photographers. Because if I'm going to go out and drop $1,000 on a Nikon scanner, I want to know that it's going to be something that's going to be supported for a reasonable amount of time, and that there's going to be reasonable warranty support and reasonable spare parts, and that I'm not buying something that's going to be totally phased out in 6 weeks. And the fact that they wouldn't just come out and just say that, and that they weren't prepared at a major photo show like this in New York to come out and just say it, really kind of surprised me. But I take it back, it didn't surprise me. But it disappointed me that they really weren't willing to step up to the plate and make that announcement.
Well, exactly. I guess there's a $64 question. So a dedicated Nikon film scanner, either 35 or medium format, you're talking a couple thousand dollars.
Yeah.
Okay, you can buy an Epson 750M for what, $850, $900?
Yeah, about that.
Buy a Cami wet mount kit for like another buck and a half. So you got a grand into an Epson gig. From what you've seen, and I think you've played with all this stuff anyway.
Yeah.
What do you think about the flatbed wet mount option compared to a dedicated film scanner? Because, I mean, the writing's on the wall. The dedicated film scanner has a bullet waiting for it.
Right.
It's done.
It does. And, I mean, I use an Imicon at my studio, and I absolutely love it. From what I understand, they are going to upgrade the software to support Snow Leopard. But I also know that Hasselblad, at some point, is going to say, that's it, we're done. I don't know when it's going to be. I don't think it's hopefully not soon. But what are the differences between the dedicated film scanner and the flatbed? A lot of it's time. The Imicon, mine does a scan very quickly. It's about 4.5 minutes for a full-res scan. Most of the flatbed scanners are much slower than that. And a lot of it's subtlety. I did some scans of some Type 55 Polaroid negatives recently. Don't we all wish that was still around? And I did it on a Microtech i900 that I still have sitting here, running some SilverFast software, doing multi-pass scan, the whole nine yards. And I did a comparison to my Imicon. And to be honest, the Microtech wasn't bad. It was actually, to be honest, quite good. But a lot of it gets down to the scanner operator. And I think that's the one thing that if you know what you're doing in scanning, and if you understand the software that's powering your scanner, you can do a lot with a little. And also getting into, well, how are you going to print it? I mean, what really are your intentions? And if you're planning on printing using free downloadable ICCs, Well, yeah, okay, you'll probably be good enough with sort of moderate skill level. But if you've got a really tweaked ICC, perhaps, that you either paid to have made or that you've made yourself, and you really understand the software, I would agree the Epson flatbed with some Cami solution would probably do an absolutely fantastic job. But if you're trying to crank out a ton of scans in a day, that's where the other scanners make sense. But for the average user, if you need something like that, send it out to the lab. That's the thing. This sort of gets into, I think, one of the discussions of how much do you realistically want to do yourself? This is something that not that many years ago, most photographers, if they were lucky, had a darkroom. And maybe would make prints 8, 10, 11, 14, but that was considered big, the darkroom, unless you really had a really nice setup. And if you wanted something bigger than that, you would send it out and have maybe a master printer make it or your local lab make it. Now, this whole digital thing has been pushed on people in the terms of you can do everything yourself. You can go out there and master this digital camera and all the 8 million different menus and customs features that are in it, which confuse the heck out of me. You can master Photoshop or scanning and all this printing and make your own ICCs and do all this stuff yourself. The thing that I'm hearing a lot of people come back to me saying is that I just want to make pictures. I want to go out and I want to photograph. And I don't necessarily want to have to maintain all this technology and do all this work in order to just make photographs. And I think that there's becoming sort of a realization within the industry that, yes, I can go out and buy an Epson printer or a Canon printer and stick a piece of paper and make a print. But can I make an exceptional quality print? Probably not without tweaking it and spending a lot of time learning about the printer. Yes, I can go out and buy one of these scanners, whether it's a flatbed or a dedicated film scanner. Can I do a good scan? Yes, but can you make an exceptional scan? Probably not without spending the time and really sort of working at it and learning it. And that's what I think most people are finding. We have a 9900 series printer here at the studio. You can have two people running that same 99, one person running the free profile that they got for X paper from the website, and the other person running a highly tweaked profile that has been custom linearized the whole nine yards. And might be the same machine, same ink, same paper, but it's not the same print at the end of the day. And once people see that, once they see that extra 10%, they want the 10% until they realize what gets into it. And so I think that a little bit of realism here that needs to get into sort of photographers' minds. So what can they realistically expect to get from their stuff? So if I was an average photographer and I was looking for just a scanner to scan my work, I would say the flatbed scanner would be a fantastic way to go, especially if you're not trying to scan 50, 60 negatives in a day. It'd be an absolutely great choice. If you've got $10,000 or $20,000 sitting around, the Imicon's a great choice too. But to be honest, the flatbed scanner would do a really good job. It's just not going to be high speed. You are going to be limited in some areas in the end. But depending upon your work style and the way you work, that might be fine.
So I guess it's not all worth giving up hope yet.
No, I'm honestly hopeful that the industry is going to come out of this better than it was going in. I cannot tell you how many people have come up to me recently and have said, I just want to shoot. And a lot of them go back to film just because they said that statement. They're sick to death of the upgrades and the cameras and the expenses and learning this and that. They're like, I just want to go out and make work. A lot of these people shot transparencies. How great was that? You went out, you shot your E6 or your Kodachrome, and you got it back, and there it was. You sent it out to your lab to have it printed if you wanted to have prints made. That was their level of involvement in the second half. But they've been told through marketing, well, now you can do everything yourself. And what they're realizing is that it's expensive, it's very time-consuming. And I think that everybody needs to sort of understand what level of interaction do you want in the entire process. It's okay to just be a shooter. That's one of the biggest things that the digital industry has done that I think hurts our industry. Most photographers were either shooters or printers. Very few photographers do both. I mean, historically speaking, you had your Ansel Adams and your Edward Westons and people like that. But most photographers that you think of either went out and shot or they printed. They didn't do both. If they did both, they didn't do both necessarily really great. And I think that the digital industry has kind of convinced everybody that you can do both. But I think there's becoming a real understanding within the industry that, A, maybe you don't want to do both because of time reasons and cost and learning curves and all that. And I tell people constantly, it's okay if you just want to shoot. It's okay if you just want to do the other end. You don't have to do it all. Because it's very hard, very expensive, and very time-consuming to sort of master the complexity of the photography industry the way it is right now. Whether you go strictly digital or some sort of hybrid form, there's a lot going on. There's a lot to learn.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. And I would rather see, honestly, myself, people go out and shoot and take their film to Costco and get developed and get prints that way than not shoot or worry about, well, I got to get this gear and I got to buy this scanner and I got to do this dark room, or I have to buy this inkjet, or I got to buy this enlarger and I got to buy this. When you know something, go out and shoot, man.
Yeah, go out and have fun. I mean, didn't we all get into photography because it was fun?
I think so.
I mean, I did. And I think that a lot of the fun is gone. I mean, that sucking sound we hear in the background is the fun, I think, leaving photography. And I think about, like you mentioned, go out and get your prints made at Costco or whatever. I tell somebody, go out and take your camera and go out to your local lab, a decent lab, and have them make you an 8x10 off an Uritsu or whatever they're running. And then go home and try to match that on your digital printer. In a lot of cases, you can't.
Yeah.
And it's because they've got good ICCs and everything is mapped out and everything is precisely calibrated. And you start to realize, wow, why did I just spend these $3,000 or $4,000 on this particular machine? And I think that digital, the new hybrid sort of way of working, is requiring photographers to think, or it should be requiring photographers to think a little bit more about what level of technology am I willing to take on? Just because I buy this printer doesn't mean I'm going to make great prints. And am I really willing to spend the time to learn? Or does it make more sense to say, I'm going to buy something smaller and sort of work with it that way? It's a question that I think a lot of people aren't asking, and they should be.
So let's talk about your new venture. We had chatted before about this new billet aluminum handcrafted pinhole camera that you've been working with. You took this to New York City with you. Tell us about this, and let's hear about some of the feedback that you got from the digital zombies at Photo Plus.
It was interesting. I mean, I had the Cuboid with me at the show. It's made by Matt Abelson of Abelson Scopeworks. And I did a lot of sort of suggestions on sort of the way the thing was made and have given a lot of feedback in terms of ergonomics, design, and sort of working with the camera. And the overall response was fantastic. I mean, everybody was kind of freaked that I'm pulling out a 120 handmade machine, the beautiful crafted aluminum pinhole camera. But people were really intrigued by it. I mean, I showed it to a couple different magazines. I showed it to photographic workshops and places like that. And they all were, wow, this is really, really, really neat. So I'm excited about it. I mean, it's a real limited productions camera. I mean, I guess we could make more of them. But right now, there's only 12 being made, primarily because the machining behind the camera is tremendous. I mean, they take 4 or 5 months to make a complete system. And they're beautiful. I mean, when you actually see it, the machining on them is just incredible. And I've been shooting with it now exclusively for the last, boy, 3.5 weeks. And we're going to actually come out with models released to the general public for sale December 1st. There'll only be 3 of them initially, and 1 of them is already sold. And then the next 6 will not be available until the end of February. So it truly is a boutique sort of camera. But if you're into pinhole, if you're into really wanting to have creative options with pinhole photography, this is a great choice. Matter of fact, one of the people who is getting the camera, I believe, is asking for a tin-type adapter for the camera. So instead of using the 120 film cassette, it'll actually take a tin type on the inside and you can use it for total all process.
Wow.
I mean, how cool is that?
That is cool.
Yeah, well, that's what's neat about the camera. I mean, it comes with a 180 micron pinhole, which on a 25 millimeter focal length works out to about f1.38. That's sort of the default f-stop. And the nice part is you're not stuck with that. So I have a whole bunch of different pinholes that I had laser made for me a few years ago. And so I've been putting different pinholes in. And it's a matter of 4 screws, and you can pop a different pinhole in, sort of going for the pinhole that gives me the visual quality that I want. And I like a very soft pinhole. I like something that's really soft and creamy. And when you look at a printed image, it looks more like a Japanese pen and ink drawing than something that's very literal. And so I'm now down to a pinhole that's f64. And that's quite a bit faster. It's quite a bit less sharp than an actual pinhole. But it's beautiful, and it's nice that I have those options in the camera. One other thing, I posted yesterday a sheet that shows this is a multi-aspect ratio camera, which is one of the things that I think is kind of unique about it. It's not like just a 6.6. This camera shoots everything from a 6.45 out to a 58x66. And it has interchangeable electroplated stainless steel masks that lock into the camera. So you have to put the mask in before you load the roll of film. But you can basically choose what aspect ratio negative you want to work with. You can also do the overlapping frame panoramic technique, where you can have frames overlapping other frames. And so you get a flicker of like a motion picture quality. But what's interesting about this camera is that the different masks give you a controllable, repeatable amount of overlap that varies from mask to mask. So if you put the 50x50 mask in, the overlap is only about a millimeter. so you can do a panoramic with a minimal amount of overlap. But if you put in the 5866, you get about a third of the frame overlap. So if you want to work in these long sort of overlapping multiple exposure pinhole images, you can, and you can choose the degree of overlap that you want for your work.
Wow, this is cool. Now, some people like to do pinholes and get a very soft and dreamy, euphoric-looking image. Some people like to shoot pinholes and still get something that's fairly sharp.
If you use the pinhole that the camera comes with, which is a precision laser-drilled pinhole, we definitely chose the best possible pinhole you could get for the camera. It produces actually quite a sharp image. I mean, it's not lens sharp, but in terms of pinhole sharp, you're going to be hard-pressed to find anything that even comes close to this. And a lot of that's because of how flat the film is. The film in this camera, because of the way the cassette is designed, is really flat. I'm talking like Hasselblad film holder flat. It's that flat. Because of the way the tension, the way the film is being pulled across the film plane, that film is extremely flat. And as a result, if with a good quality pinhole, it's amazing how sharp the images really look. And if you're using a tripod, all the better. Now, I don't use a tripod when I shoot pinhole. So I hand hold images in some cases and exposures that are 30 seconds, a minute, 8 seconds, 20 seconds. I mean, these are very long exposures. But because pinhole builds the images very slowly over a long period, it's amazing how little that motion of me hand-holding these things really shows up. And it's really beautiful.
All this information on this camera is going to be available on your website?
Yeah, right now, actually, I registered another domain. I can't believe I am actually going to have another domain. I've got way too many websites, but I decided I needed another URL. So the URL is going to be www.thecuboid, because I couldn't get cuboid, but I got thecuboid, cuboid.com. And that'll be up probably in under a week to 10 days. Right now, if you go to Digital Revolution, there's a video that I did with Matt Abelson where it's 10 minutes long, and it's really a great video. It goes through, and he talks about the entire process of making the camera. From the fact that it starts out as a solid 4.5-pound block of aluminum, and in the end, it's a 17-ounce, beautiful, handmade photographic tool. And it walks through the entire process of the CNC machining, everything. And then the second post that I just did, once again, if you just type in cuboid in the search and Digital Revolution, it'll come up, shows you all the different film aspect ratios and what all the different overlapping frames look like. And it actually tells you how big the actual negative will be in inches to whole nine yards. So you can say, wow, I can make an 11-inch negative or a 5-inch negative by doing these overlaps. And so it shows you single frames, double overlap, and triple overlap, all side by side. So it's a wonderful little sheet to be able to sit there and look at and say, what do I want?
No, that is cool. And this is a beautiful piece. And when they look at the video, also, we're going to have the video here up on Inside Analog Photo TV so people can see it if they're not looking at your feed, and we can cross promote this way. But I think it's a very unique piece of gear. And I think what's so cool about it, it's a new piece of gear made for analog photography.
Yeah, I mean, when was the last time you heard of a new film camera?
Exactly.
No batteries, nothing in the thing. Everything in the camera literally was custom machined. When you actually hold one and you look at one, it's a really beautiful camera. It really is. If you're looking for a pinhole camera to do really sharp stuff, leave the 138 or the 180 micron pinhole in there, stick it on a tripod, and it's beautiful. I mean, it really, really is beautiful.
Oh, it is. And I think that looking at the video and when people see this thing, it looks like Matt could just put a lens mount on the front. You could put a leaf shutter lens on it, then it would be a brand new medium format camera.
Yeah, I mean, the engineering on it's definitely a little overboard. There's no doubt. I mean, the engineering and the machining and the quality of the pinholes and the springs that we used and just the way the whole camera functions, it was designed to sort of fill in the gaps that a lot of other pinhole cameras had. I approached Matt initially on this project saying, look, I want a pinhole camera for my own use that I can travel around the world with, throw in a bag, using rain, snow, sleet. I don't care. I want it to work. And I want it to work every single time. And so this has got an internal shutter, which is really nice. There's nothing on the outside. And we've got one for sure accessory coming out probably in December or January. We're actually making a machined dust cover that will actually go over the entire front of the camera, lock into the tripod socket. So if you're going to be in really horrendous dust, you can protect the pinhole as well.
Now, how cool is that?
Yeah, it really is going to be neat. I mean, we've given a lot of thought to what's the best way to attach this thing. And at the end of the day, like it is in so many things, the simplest solution is probably the best solution. So it'll have a precision mount that'll protect the entire front of the camera. And everything in the camera is recessed. So unlike a lot of other pinhole cameras that have shutters on the outside, it's really easy when you're putting that in and out of your bag to accidentally take a photograph of the inside of your bag as the outside shutter can move up and down. On this one, everything is inside. So when you pick it up, it's a cube. I mean, it's about the size of a large peach. I mean, it's not very big. I think it's like 3 by 3.5 inches.
Is there a way to hook a strap on it to put it over your shoulder?
Well, you totally could, because it's got the tripod socket. I have a wrist strap.
That would go on the bottom. Perfect, yeah.
Yeah, I've got it screwed right into the tripod socket on the bottom, and that way I can walk around. It just sort of dangles from my hand, and it's a nice way to carry.
No, this is cool. So, Stephen, where do we find out more information about the Phygital Revolution, about your beautiful analog photography, and all the 15,000 websites that you're up to?
It is kind of scary. There are two main core websites. There's the Phygital Revolution, which is just Phygital, F-I-G-I-T-A-L, revolution.com. That's the site where I write articles on all aspects of analog and digital technologies. That also has links to my other primary site, which is Indian Hill Image Works. And that's where we do scanning and printing and teaching and consulting and all that kind of stuff under our studios. That's also the site, the Indian Hill Image Works site, where the cuboid will be for sale. My e-store where I sell a few of the products that I make is on that site. And probably within the next 2 weeks, I'll have the actual category page set up for the cuboid, and people will be able to order them. One thing about the cuboid is that it's not an inexpensive camera. And Matt and I are very aware when we made it, because we kept adding up, wow, this is getting more expensive to make. But we don't want to sacrifice on quality. Okay, go ahead and spend the extra $20 or $100 and buy the better materials. The camera is selling for $1,440.41. So it's like 1444441. Is it the most expensive pinhole square little camera? Well, it very well might be, but it's also the best made. And it's not for everybody, but if you're into pinhole photography, if you want to have the option of doing the tintype thing like I mentioned, if you want the ability of an interchangeable f-stop, you could also put a zone plate in this, you could put a photon sieve in this, this is definitely something that you should consider.
Yeah, this is great stuff. I appreciate the report on the new camera and, of course, the report of Photo Plus Expo for analog photographers and what's been going on there. And I really appreciate the time again, and we look forward to chatting here real soon, buddy.
Sounds great.
There you go. Stephen Schaub, the leader of the Phygital Revolution. Great report there about Photo Plus Expo and everything else that's going on with Stephen, the new camera stuff they're working on, and just a nice chat about the state of analog photography. The Inside Analog Photography radio program is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful over at www.fujifilmusa.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. DR5 over at www.dr5.com. Iger Studios over at igerstudios.com. Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. And of course, our media partners, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, over at www.apug.org. Our photography philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.geh.org. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photography Radio. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.